I'm very pleased to welcome to our congregation this morning someone I've known for a number of years during my time here in Nashua, Mr. Harvey Key, very much a part of this community in any number of ways. Found his way to Nashua some years ago after growing up in Birmingham, Alabama in the 40s and in the 40s and 50s. For a time he served in our New Hampshire state legislature and was very instrumental seeing that Martin Luther King Day was observed as a state holiday here in New Hampshire as the push for making it a national holiday was going on. As I say, his community involvements are numerous. He's past chair of the New Hampshire Human Rights Council, director for a time of Big Brothers Big Sisters of Nashua, has connections with many of the members in our congregation here, Russ Leonard, Steve Ledoux, who lit the chalice, Harry, Jim. In fact, these were the guys who were saying, we gotta get Harvey in here on some on one of these Martin Luther King Sundays. Harvey works with them and with the New Hampshire Prostate Cancer Coalition. Harvey, it's great to have you here. Come on up. Let's hear. All right.
Good morning, America.
Good morning.
The home of diversity in speech and religion and all the other ones that you need to know about. Because of you, this is going to be a wonderful day because you're here. Thank you very much. Since I left this, I'll get to part of that, but the choir is much better. They couldn't sing like this 30 years ago. I don't know who added what. Maybe it was Harry. Yeah, I'm not sure. But I know Harry can't sing. He can barely talk to me many times. But I am so pleased to be here. I could scream, and I'm going to do some screaming about the situation that we face in this country and here in Nashua. But allow me a few seconds just to give you a prologue of why I'm on this stage today, 2/11, on Martin Luther King's Day. My family and I moved here about 40 years ago from upstate New York. And we didn't move into Boston because they had a sign down there that says, "No Negroes will be riding this bus," and it was led by Louise Day Hicks. Many of you perhaps too young to remember that, but we chose not to go to Boston because of that reason, so we came to Nashua. And my wife, I think you've seen her. We've been married 51 years. And we've moved 19 times. And she's in charge of every move. We moved to Nashua, and I know we looked at least 150 houses before we settled over on Radcliffe Drive. And when she said, "That is it," that was it. No argument for me, because I was worn out looking at houses. And on that street, there was a guy and his wife, Paul and Cynthia Fios. Some of you may or may not know them. They've been members of the church for 100 years. Well, not that old yet. But Paul invited me to come to church. And I hadn't been to church because I fell out with churches. I got tired of the churches, what they were saying and not doing much. And where I had come from, I was accustomed to performance measurement. That's about a lot of things. I wanted to tell you earlier this prologue of why about me. I want you to understand, if you hear the southern drawl, it's because I'm from Birmingham, Alabama. And I tried to change it desperately, and I couldn't because I was so ashamed to be from Birmingham. And I'm still trying to change it. Do you get a little drift? Do you? No? Yeah? Okay? Is it okay? And if you begin to tear up, if you like, be my guest, because this is going to get a little emotional, maybe. But my wife told me just a minute ago, she says, well, there's a way you don't have to cry, because they refuse to come to some of these things because I get upset. The scar is still there. So, 38 years ago, we moved here. We looked at 150 houses, and we were living there. And we had the pleasure of meeting Paul Fowles and Cynthia Fowles. And he knew nothing of my past, except the fact that I worked for Colgate Palmolive Company. And the church he brought me to was this church. And at that time, Reverend Dr. John Riley was the minister. And he was talking about the service that Martin Luther King was given, and what the biggest thing that we can do is give and serve other people. And I looked around, and I was the only face in this church of color. I said, what is this guy doing, talking to me? I didn't kill it. You know, they just shot him in 1968. This is 1971 when we were here, or 72. But I said, why is he talking to me like this? But I came to find out that that's the spirit of this congregation. And that has been the spirit. I joined the church, of course. And I have been a proud member ever since. I want you to know that this is not an easy task. This speaking business is tough. I've been right. I was at, some gentleman just mentioned, he was at the First Baptist Church last night. I was there. And I was down in Boston, another thing, trying to figure out what in the world can I say that is so important that we could remember Martin Luther King. Well, I know that I can't compete with those guys who are professional speakers. And I know I can't sing the songs like they sang them. And I chose that I'm not going to talk about a speech. I'm not going to talk about what remembering Martin Luther King. I'm going to talk about how my childhood, how I grew up in Birmingham, and how I was affected by racism and hate and nastiness and ugliness and the inhumanity to humanity. And then I'm going to talk about how that transfer affected me, because I was expelled from public high school, and how that affected me. And then I'm going to tell you what I think we ought to be doing as human beings to one another and with one another. Steve Addington mentioned earlier that we had something in common. And I didn't know if he called it racism or not, but he lived in the southern part of West Virginia where he couldn't go into swimming pools. And he felt strange enough to change that and not go to swimming pools. He said to me, because I came over to sit with him and chat about this on Friday, or maybe Thursday, I'm not sure. But had he brought me out here and had me stand in front of all you people looking at me, I would have said, no, that's all right. I'll make the speech next year. This is awesome. This is a big job. So, but Steve, I wanted to let him know that...
You're not. Keep talking. And we'll mic up.
I want to let him know that West Virginia is no comparison to Birmingham, Alabama. None. He had it easy. He could go into any of these pools that he wanted to. I couldn't go to any pool in Birmingham. And someone asked me recently, do you know how to swim? I said, no. And the reason I don't know how to swim is because we weren't allowed in the swimming pool. We had to go to Isley, which is about 12 or 13 miles away, to use a pool. Because if you're poor, you didn't have any money, you couldn't walk about 13 miles. So as a result, I didn't. Yet, I'm going to learn. After Steve and one of my other mentors in this congregation mentioned the fact that I would be okay up here, it didn't take much
reflection for me to say yes. And I'm so pleased that I did. And I've never been here before. So I didn't know that all of those stares right at me makes you a little nervous. So I accepted this wonderful opportunity, and then I listened to my heart. I visited the church last night. I went to Boston. I talked to people. Martin Luther King wrote 5 books, a lot of papers, and I tried to read some of them. I read them before, and I thought about them and concentrated on them. And I'm not sure if I got much out of what he said except service and prayer and giving and being nice to people. And then I added some of my own words, being nicer every day to people. And of course, he would say the same thing, I'm sure. I think remembering Dr. King is not enough. I think we've been doing that for the number of years he's been dead. And we're still doing that today, remembering Dr. King for a week. And at the church we were last night, they had Dr. King's picture, photograph, next to the cross. There's a cross of Jesus and the cross, you know. And I think next week they're going to take it down. And I just wonder, why this 1 week? Why not whole year? I also think that if we became angry enough,
How's this? Better? All right. You're a politician to Mike, man. I better not leave this way. I get some converts over here, Steve. But I don't think remembering Martin Luther King is good enough. And I don't want to try to give you a speech because I can't compete with those professionals. What I want to do is have a conversation with you about my life in Birmingham, how I came in contact with Martin Luther King. I marched in Birmingham with Martin Luther King. I wasn't with him. I've never met him except once. And I wasn't close to that march because I had my little boy on my shoulders, and I wasn't going to get close to the dogs and the hoses that were at 16th Street and 4th Avenue in Birmingham. So I was there, and I marched half step in the back of the march. I wasn't up there to get hit with a billy club or be kicked or bitten by a dog. I got a little sense, even though I'm from Birmingham. So, I think I can do without this mic. Is that all right?
No. The other one's working, yeah.
Is it working okay? Yeah. Now, I got 2 of them now. I grew up in Birmingham at a hospital called Hillman Hospital. At that time, it was a colored hospital. It wasn't a colored hospital. It was a hospital that had two wards. One was white, one was colored. And that colored thing lasted for a long time. I'm not sure if it's still around. Negroes became the operative word, but at that time, colored was a word. So I was born in Hillman Hospital, which is now the University of Alabama, one of the leading universities in the world for all kinds of research. And I was taken to my house, which was a two-room house next to a railroad. I wasn't alone. Everybody in my community had a two-room house. And we had a two-block community. Now, if you've seen Tobacco Road, I didn't need to see it because I lived. We had 2 rooms. We cooked on a stove where we had to go out and get the wood and the coal. And since we lived next to the railroad, I could go out and hop the train and throw some coal and wood off the train on the ground. So when the train left, we had something to cook with.
Now, that was not only brave, but a little bit dangerous and not smart. But if you have to use that, that's what we did. Learn how to read by taking a newspaper and on the floor, and putting paste on it, you don't know anything about this. We took flour and water and made a glue to put the paper on the wall to keep the wind from coming through the cracks. Well, at Birmingham, there wasn't a lot of wind, except that when it got to be 40 or 50 degrees, man, it got to be cold. So we did that. I learned how to read by taking somebody's, the white people's newspaper, and put them on a wall. At that time, we didn't have, and I sort of lost my place here because I was telling you another story. Because I don't want to give you a speech. I want to talk about me growing up. It was tough. I was afraid of white people because I was taught to be afraid of white people. I was told that when you're walking down the street and you see a white person, get off the street and let them pass. And I was taught that kind of fear. And I'm a little boy, you know. I grew up in Birmingham for 17 years, and that's not pretty. Of course, I thought it was okay because everybody was doing it. I wasn't any different than other colored people who lived in this two-block area, which is dumpy color. I didn't get mad until I became a man that they treated me that way. My mother, who would go into a department store, could not try on a hat for Easter. She had to buy the hat and take it home. If it didn't fit, throw it away. Do anything you want to do with it. That's a little cruel. And I didn't recognize that until later. Going to school, I went to elementary school where all the teachers were colored, and they were very good. I learned how to read and write pretty well, I think. And when I went to high school, which was Parker High School in Birmingham, it was the magnet school, and with a city of 500,000 people, all of the colored kids, we had 6,000 kids in this high school. It was the biggest high school south of Mason Dixon, I believe. And that's where I got to be a tough dude. In my section of the tent, if you didn't learn to fight, you got your butt kicked every day. And being a half-white Negro, I was picked on a lot. There was no advantage. So I wasn't a big, strong guy with a lot of muscles, but I could run real fast, and I ran a lot. But then I got tired of running, so I went to the drugstore and spent a quarter, bought a knife. So now I'm the tough guy in my area because we'll tell you a little bit about that other thing later. I lived in North Birmingham in Ocypico. Ocypico is a big major pipe shop. They played baseball against Fairfield Industries, which Willie Mays attended. I saw him when he was 16, 17 years old. He could hit a ball 3 miles. And I think he might be able to do that now. Not sure. But Ocypico had not much education. I mean, the whole town. Nobody on my street finished elementary school. They all went to work to make the money because the foundries were there. So they weren't educated like 120 miles away at Atlanta. Atlanta is the mecca of colored schools, black schools, Negro schools at that time. And there's a world of difference between Birmingham and Atlanta. It still is. The people in Atlanta are mostly educated and upward mobile and middle class in Birmingham. I think we're still getting there. We haven't gotten there yet. So I became the bad dude. Went to school this one day, and this guy said to me some things, and he was going to kick my so-and-so. And I said, yeah, you want to do that? And I had my knife. And he brought his weapon to school, which was a thing this long with nails driven to the end of it. I don't know where he got that idea, but it scared me enough. And I took care of him. I stabbed him a few times. And of course, I went to jail. And I thought I should protect myself, but I didn't have that kind of rationale at that time. I didn't have that thinking process. I just did what I thought was instinctively thing to do, and all the people in my street would have done the same thing. I went to jail. I was accused of and charged with assault and battery with attempt to murder. At 14, I was put in not in a correctional center for kids, but with adults. And I had no option. I had to do what they said to do. So when I got in there, they took the handcuffs off, took me in. Lo and behold, most of the people in there was from my street. Said, "Come on in, Harvey, I'm gonna tell Mrs. Lilly about you." Well, Miss Lilly was a tough lady. Miss Lilly had to make a living the best way she could. She sold moonshine, barbecue ribs, roasted peanuts, and I was the guy who carried the moonshine. Hey, those are the days. They worked out all right. So, the community, I happened to be a pretty good guy, and I was pretty good at math and English, and the community got me out of this jam called assault and battery with attempted murder. I was transferred to a Not transfer, I was put out of Parker High. Mr. Johnson said, "You can't come here anymore." And the only other school to go to was Immaculata High School. So I went to Immaculata and I met this white lady whose name is Sister Mary Honora. And I think they gave her the name because of her nose. Her nose was like this. And Sister Mary Honora greeted me and said, "I've heard about you. Come on in. And I want you to know something." She took my hand. She says, "If you want to become somebody, you can. You have to find that somebody inside. You find your soul, and you can become anybody you want to become." And she said, "While you are here at Immaculata High School," she took my other hand, and she had a ruler about this long, "I'm going to help you." She said, "When you get out of line, I'm going to get you back in line." Well, I went there in the 10th grade. I graduated with honors. And I told you to bring your hanky. I won a scholarship to college. My whole destiny changed. I was supposed to be dead or in jail. And here I am in college. Can you imagine that? Wow. Well, you did that. Thank you. I give you a break. That's really how I got to college. And maybe that was an opportunity, I'm not sure. It didn't get me down. I had some people support me, and some people love me, in particular this nun and the Catholic school, and thank you very much. Went off to college. And in the Korean conflict, which started, I was in college in 50, finished in 54, was deferred from the Army, and that was the Korean conflict. Came back to Birmingham and couldn't get a job. I had a degree in chemistry and biology, and I couldn't get a job at the University of Alabama because, you know, your skin color is not right. And I said, "Well, maybe I can get a job in the janitorial department." And they said, "Well, you have too much education." Yeah, boy. So I went to the country. If you've ever gone to Birmingham, Alabama, there's a fabulous, fabulous country club called The Country Club. It sits on top of the mountain where the Vulcan is. Birmingham is a steel-making city. They make a lot of coal and iron ore and stuff like that. And the people who own those places are very rich. At any rate, I got a job over there, and I was a waiter. So that was good. And I got tired of that. And I'd gone to the war to fight for this country. And we had just finished World War II, where we fought with two armies. One was black. It wasn't called black, it was called color. And the other one was white. You know about that? The two armies we fought for freedom of everybody in this country, with two armies, one white and one black, can you imagine? We still have some things to do. At any rate, I decided that because we could not eat in places where white people ate, or if we ate there, we had to go in the back door. I don't want to do that. I've gone to fight for this country, and I'm not going to do it in the back door. So me, with my smart self, I'm having nothing to do with journalism, Harry. I put out a little newspaper called Inside of Birmingham. It wasn't a newspaper, it was a pamphlet, a three-folder, and it simply says, eat where you're liked. And I did this for maybe a month and a half, 2 months. Bull Connor, you know the name? George Wallace, you know the name? Got wind of that, and they ran me out of the city of Birmingham. Get out, don't come back again. If you do, we'll shoot you. Just like that. Well, I went to Cleveland, and I got a job at the Western Reserve University Medical School, because I had this chemistry background in biology, and by that time I could really sort of wax a little bit. And as a medical researcher assistant, working with a pharmacologist from Japan, we found out some things about the cell. What makes the cell tick and where the energy comes from and all that kind of thing. But I was really concerned about why were white people so different than me? And I'm in the lab and I go to the pathology department. I'm down in the morgue and we have to get tissues out of cadavers to do the research. Well, I did more than a research. I went down to the basic cell of a variety of different races and centrifuged them down and assayed them, and you know what I found? No difference. I'm just like you are. I just don't look like you. And boy, what a relief, because I thought we were inherently different. And I had that belief for a long time. At any rate, I went back to Birmingham because my mother got sick. And I wanted to go to med school. So I thought I'd get her admitted to a home, a hospital. And I went to Atlanta and enrolled at Atlanta University to continue my studies in biology. My mother got sick again, so I had to go back to Birmingham. And now I'm angry. I have a German Luger that shoots 9 times, and I'm packing. Don't mess with me, folks. I'm just equal to you. I'm going to eat where I want to eat, because I fought for this country, and you're not going to tell me I can't eat in a restaurant that's open to the public. I had a cousin whose name is James Lay. He's no longer with us. That's why I mentioned his name. Now, if you know Birmingham, there's the A.G. Gaston's Motel, the only motel in all of the city of Birmingham where colored folks, Negroes, could stay. They couldn't stay at Tutwiler. They couldn't stay at, they didn't have any. And in what is that motel that says, I'll leave the light on for you? Motel Sixes? They didn't have any of those. So, we were at the motel. having a drink. Martin Luther King, Shuttlesworth, J.T. Walker, R.T. Walker, Mr. Walker, Reverend Walker, and all of those guys came to the motel through a courtyard. And they were going to go upstairs and rest. And we were just hanging out. And all at once, there's loud noise and this big bang and cinder blocks flew. And James and I, we are ready. Because we know that the Ku Klux Klan has done a lot of bad things. And they were waiting. We didn't know that, for Martin Luther King, Thurgood Marshall, or any of those people who would come to town. So on our way out to do whatever we were going to do, Martin Luther King said, "Hey guys," and I'm not sure if he said it like that or not, but he said, "Stop it. We don't do business that way." That was the bottom line. We can do better. You are better than that. And at that moment, I didn't have a transformation. But I remembered what Sister Mary Honora said. Not at that moment.
Better? No?
It's
okay?
But I had this, it was so mysterious that he said, and I didn't know, Martin Luther King didn't have the name that,
Is that better?
Yeah.
Where are you, Steve? But Martin Luther King was a preacher down in Montgomery. And he was doing some things and pretty much known, but he didn't have the notoriety that he has later on, and because he was not necessarily a peacemaker, and he was not perfect. He was not violent. But he wanted to get some things done, and some things that were done against the cities that were not treating people right. You know what? I have skipped 5 or 6 pages here. But at any rate, Martin Luther King said to James and I, that you can't do that. That's not the way we do whatever we do. And it wasn't a long kind of speech, but his voice, the tone of his voice, and the intent of his voice sort of cooled the anger in me. And he said, "Put your guns away or put your weapons away and go home." We did. And since that time, and not necessarily that night, but since that time, I've been a disciple of peace and service. And I think Martin Luther King and Sister Mary Honora had a huge impact on my life. And they happened to be, well, she happened to be white, and he happened to be spiritual. And I wasn't either one of those a long time ago. All of my life, up until a certain point, I've been treated by white people not very nice. And I don't think they intended it for me. It was just the way things were in the South. And I wasn't alone. You know? But you know the situation. But I think that built up a certain amount of anger in me that caused me to have those kinds of reactions to the public as I grew older. And when I got to be older, I began to find ways to deal with our fences. There's a fence between a lot of us. We don't know each other, and when we don't know each other, it causes fear, and the fear causes anger, and the anger causes hostility. And as a result of all of that kind of stuff, we are still miles and miles away as human beings. And I'm going to suggest that we begin to tear out of those fences. And one way to do that is to say hello and try to be as nice to each other as possible. And what I got from Martin Luther King and Sister Mary Honora and a large part of the South, is simply trying to be nice to those people that you come in contact with every day, and the next day a little bit nicer. And we have that capacity, we have that potential, but we have to use it, and we have to intentionally use it. And I think we could make it a lot better. And I see somebody saying, what does this mean, Harry?
And your tie is too tight.
It says, what would Martin Luther King say today? And I think everybody wants to know this. I don't know what he would say. But I think if he said something like to parents, I think he would say, begin to parent again. Stop allowing your kids to tell you what to do. And if they use profanity to you and your household, their address changes the next day. You don't live here anymore. Stop blaming others for your mistakes. You're responsible for your mistakes. Your mother and your father and all the others are not. And they're not sick. If they were sick, why treat you? Treat the mother and father if they cause it. I don't know, it's a little bit confusing. That's okay. Ask yourselves, young people, if you would feel better without having 18 to 20 excuses for not doing something. How would you feel? Reverse that and see how you feel. Failure in school is not an option. In our country, we go to school 4 to 5 hours a day for 5 days a week. In other countries, we go to school 8 hours a day for 6 days a week. And where do you think we're going to be 20 years from now? Pull up your pants. Nobody's interested in looking at your underwear. We have a dysfunctional political system. We have 535 people in Washington. We have 15,000 lobbyists. Each of those people will go down to Washington, get $175,000 a year, and when they retire, they get $15,000 a month. You still want to support that? You might have some changes in your heart. I know I do. Those people who are in jail, one in every 20 today's blacks or Negroes or colored people, whatever, are incarcerated. In the white population, it's one in every 80. In the black population, it's one in every 9 of black males who are between 24 and 35 years old. If that's not killing a race, I don't know what is. And we sit here, we do nothing about it. And don't you forget, 6 million Jews, 20 million Russians, 10 million Christians, 2,000 priests, nuns, were raped, and gassed, and whipped, and beaten, starved, and marched to their deaths. And we sat by and did nothing. We can't afford to do that. We have to. There are consequences to that. And someone says, who killed the lady in Arizona? You can read the papers. A large number of answers. But one of the answers could be America. Because what we don't do and the way we treat each other, the nastiness, this ugliness, the bad tone and eye contact, get off the street, this is mine, not yours, has consequences. How they come to the surface, none of us will never know. But they do come to the surface, and we have to pay them. This is almost the end. But I want you to know that we need differences, and we must have differences. And that is what underscores our humanity. We are bound by our limitations. And that's why we need one another. And if we ever dare take the fence down and say hi, we'll get there. Thank God Almighty, we are almost free at last.
Thank you, Herman. Thank you so much. All right. Yeah, we're going to...